You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Associated Press recently investigated all possible cases of voter fraud in the 2020 election over six battleground states, including Wisconsin. We'll talk to one of the reporters behind the investigation about what they found. Now, a series of videos from PBS Wisconsin showcases the legacies of Wisconsinites who made history. There's Millie Zantow, who helped bring plastic recycling to the United States, Mildred Fish Harnack, who stole Nazi secrets during World War II, and many more. Mia Forslund is a coordinating producer for PBS Wisconsin Education, who played a big part in putting Wisconsin biographies together. Mia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us, Mia, a bit about the history of Wisconsin biographies and some of the recent updates you've made to it?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin Biographies is a collection from PBS Wisconsin Education that is made for grades 3 through 6 and shares, as you said, the stories of people who have shaped Wisconsin's history. And the collection launched almost 10 years ago. And since its first launch, we've continued to add stories to the collection and are currently working on more stories to add.
And what kind of things can, say, a teacher go to and then end up using in a classroom?
As part of the collection, they can find animated videos, also biography books, which we have now added per page audio to, as well as historical image galleries. And then for them as educators, we have some helpful resources, including guides and a quick start chart to help them navigate the collection.
Let's take a listen to one of the videos with the Wisconsin biography about Vel Phillips, Father James Grappi, and their work to end housing discrimination against Black Milwaukeeans.
The Black community was hurting. Something had to give. Two people bravely stepped up to lead the way. Vel Phillips and Father James Grappi were an unlikely pair of heroes. Vel's story is a tale of firsts. She became the first African-American woman to become a Milwaukee alderwoman and to introduce a fair housing law.
Listen, I just didn't see why I should not be able to live anywhere in the city that I could afford to live.
James Grappi put himself through seminary school driving buses. While few others bothered to listen to the troubles of the inner core, this bus driver lent an ear.
Just one sample from Wisconsin Biographies. Mia, could you tell us a little more about the cause and the story you tell in this video?
You know, that story is one where Vel Phillips and Father James Grappi were very involved in their communities and were hearing about the discrimination that was taking place and decided to take action and rallied their communities around them and took steps with marching through the streets as well as proposing legislation to make those changes happen and ultimately were successful in having official recognition of the unfair housing discrimination that was taking place and brought their community together in the process.
Here's another sample. Joe B. Xiong was a Hmong American who came to the U.S. as a refugee from Laos and went on to be a pillar of the community in Eau Claire.
Joe B. was civic-minded. I always felt that I could make a difference and help people have their voices heard. He did just that beginning in Laos when he aided his fellow villagers in escaping communist control, and then again here in Wisconsin, protecting and serving as a police officer, a social worker, and the director at the city's Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. My father was also the first Hmong American elected to the Eau Claire City Council, or actually to any elected office in the entire state.
Mia, can you talk about the range of stories you tell? You cover a lot of ground geographically, socially, and even through time.
Absolutely. So our collection currently includes 16 stories, but again, it's growing. And these stories come from before Wisconsin was a state all the way through to, pretty current times. While these people who are no longer with us, their impacts definitely live on. And some of the ways they've shaped our stories and our lives today have to do with the ways our communities are set up, some of the steps we've taken to protect the environment, ways that we have fought for people's rights, and also just so many things to think about in how we experience our everyday.
You reached out, I understand, to teachers and others in the education world to find out how they use this tool. What kind of things did you hear from them?
we heard so many great things that, you know, they were using them in a lot of exciting projects with students in their classrooms. But again, since this collection has been online for quite some time, we heard from them too about opportunities to better meet the needs of their students by adding audio to the books, by thinking about how do we offer really robust educator support materials that can help them when they have limited time but really want to bring these resources into their classrooms. Also just, you know, little things that happen behind the scenes, and we're able to add captions and transcripts in Spanish language to support those multilingual learners throughout our education communities, as well as being able to really just dig into the books and ensure that they meet a wide variety of reading levels.
If teachers or parents, for that matter, are interested, where should they go to find these Wisconsin biographies and all the supporting material?
They should check out pbswisconsineducation.org/biographies, and they will find the full collection there.
Mia, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mia Forsland is a coordinating producer for PBS Wisconsin Education. She talked to us about the PBS Wisconsin project, Wisconsin Biographies. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy to tell us about a rivalry between the popular advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Legendary advice columnist Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren dished out wise and witty advice to millions of readers for more than half a century. The two were also twins and sometimes bitter rivals. But before they were famous, they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for more than a decade. Dean Robbins brings you the story of the sisters who perhaps could have used some advice themselves.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren were America's leading advice columnists from the 1950s into the 21st century. Dear Abby was the world's most widely syndicated newspaper column with 110 million readers. Ask Ann Landers wasn't far behind with 90 million. Each writer solved other people's problems, answering letters with homespun wisdom. However, their own problems with each other proved harder to solve. Ann and Abby became bitter professional rivals, but once upon a time, they were inseparable twin sisters, raising families a mile away from each other in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Born Pauline and Eppie Friedman in Sioux City, Iowa in 1918, they grew up doing everything together. They even had a double wedding in identical dresses and veils. In the 1940s, the twins moved to Eau Claire, where both of their husbands had jobs at the National Presto Appliance Company. Pauline and Eppie cut glamorous figures in their new community. They hosted elaborate parties, volunteered for local charities, and led parades in a Cadillac convertible. They also loved to watch the Eau Claire Bears baseball team at Carson Park, turning heads with their lacquered hairstyles. But by the end of their decade in Eau Claire, cracks appeared in the sisters' relationship. Pauline and her millionaire husband lived in a stately two-story, while Eppie and her poorer husband had a small two-bedroom that Pauline dubbed Peanut Place. They even began trading insults about each other's daughters. The stage was set for a blow-up, and it happened shortly after the twins left Eau Claire in 1954. First, Eppie took over the Ann Landers advice column at the Chicago Sun-Times. A mere 3 months later, Pauline jumped into the advice biz herself, starting Dear Abby under the pen name Abigail Van Buren at the San Francisco Chronicle. Eppie saw it as a hostile gesture, and the sisters stopped speaking. In 1958, a Life magazine article gave them a national platform for their quarrel. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, Pauline sneered, but I was. Eppie retorted, she's just like a kid who beats a dog until somebody looks and then starts petting it. Ouch. The magazine declared it the most feverish female feud since Elizabeth sent Mary, Queen of Scots, to the chopping block. The dueling advice columnists reconciled in 1964, but hard feelings remained. In a 1979 TV appearance, Eppie claimed she never read Dear Abby. In a magazine interview 2 years later, Pauline mocked Eppie as envious and inferior. For good measure, she said her twin looked old. Ouch again. Eppie died in 2002 and Pauline in 2013, concluding the saga of Ann Landers versus Abigail Van Buren. you have to wonder if, at the end of their lives, they pined for the innocent pleasures of Eau Claire. Yes, both had become wildly successful since their time in Wisconsin, hailed as America's most influential women. But would they have traded all that to be back in Carson Park, arm in arm, blissfully cheering the Bears baseball team?
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the AP's review of every case of reported potential voter fraud in the 2020 election across six battleground states, and we'll find out what the findings showed up here in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Ideas Network has special programming tonight for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. At 8 o'clock, join us for a special MLK Day edition of Why Race Matters. Angela Fitzgerald of PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Life is your host. Find out more at WPR.org. Now, the Associated Press recently released an investigation into possible instances of voter fraud in the 2020 election. They looked at cases in six battleground states, including Wisconsin. They found that across all six states, the number of reported possible voter fraud cases amounted to less than 0.5% of the votes President Joe Biden won by. The findings come as former President Trump continues to repeat false and unsupported claims that the 2020 election was rigged. Christina Cassidy was the lead reporter on the AP investigation. She focuses on voting, election administration, and efforts to secure U.S. elections. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, can you tell us how you and the team went about investigating these cases in six states?
Sure. So we started by basically hearing what everyone heard after the 2020 election, which was concerns that there was widespread voter fraud. So we decided to launch this project to find the voter fraud from the 2020 election. So we focused on, as you mentioned, the six key states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And I, along with reporters in those states, contacted local election officials to talk to them about what they had identified in terms of their processes post-election for any suspicious activity, any potential cases of voter fraud. And as you noted, we found at the time it was fewer than 475 cases of potential voter fraud across those six states.
And I want to break that down a little more. In many cases, if I'm reading you right, those votes didn't actually end up happening or getting counted, right?
Correct. Because of the various processes in place in local election offices across the country, voter fraud, while it occurs, is generally detected and remains exceptionally rare. And that's because of those processes that are in place at the local level where, you know, for instance, mail ballots, those are logged every time a mail ballot is requested or sent, and that's assigned to a specific voter. And so when that ballot comes back in, it is similarly logged. In a number of states, there are voter signature reviews that are conducted. And through this process, oftentimes any potential double voting, multiple ballots, this is identified through the process, and those double votes are prevented from occurring in the first place.
When it comes to the partisan side of this, I know probably we don't know which candidate many of these voters intended to vote for. Of those that we do, what did you see? What was the split?
Well, certainly voter fraud, as much of society, is bipartisan. It occurred by Democratic voters and Republican voters. In fact, there was one gentleman in Wisconsin who we had interviewed and spoke with who was on parole and didn't know that he was not eligible to vote. And he told us all he wanted to do was to vote for President Trump. And so he says that he asked if he could vote, and it ended up that, you know, as you know, Wisconsin is not one of those states that have loosened rules surrounding felons being eligible to vote, and so he was not supposed to vote, in fact.
And that highlights another piece of the story here. In some of these cases, the story isn't someone who says, I'm going to go do voter fraud. It's I got the voter rules wrong and accidentally did some voter fraud. Is that a fairly common story out of the 400 and some cases you looked at?
Absolutely. We found a number of instances that were administrative errors where, you know, the election officials had made a mistake, had made it, you know, appear that, you know, maybe there had been a potential fraud, but in fact, there wasn't. There were mistakes as well. But then, of course, there were also, you know, people who appeared to take intentional action to commit voter fraud.
We're talking to Christina Cassidy, reporter for the Associated Press state government team, looking at an AP investigation in six battleground states, including Wisconsin, looking back at the 2020 election, finding relatively very few cases of voter fraud. They looked at what led to those reported cases. Christina, I think someone who's worried about voter fraud might say, well, those are the ones that were detected. How do we know that there's not lots of undetected voter fraud slipping through?
Well, that goes back to what we were speaking about just a few moments ago in terms of the various protocols and procedures that are in place in local election offices all across the country. So I mentioned that there is logging of ballots. So there's also, for instance, if you are someone who shows up at a polling place on election day, and you had requested a mail ballot, that information will be known at your polling place. And depending on the office, depending on the jurisdiction, you may be issued a provisional ballot, which will only count if, in fact, there's no mail ballot that was also turned in to that election office in your name. Or they will cancel that mail ballot, allow you to vote a regular ballot. And that way, if for some reason a ballot turns up, it is not counted. So those are the types of rules and procedures sort of on the front end. But then also, there's a lot of work that's done to reconcile the books, essentially. So through the post-election, the post you know, the certification process, the reviews, local election officials have to account for every voter who requested a ballot, all the number of ballots that came in. And if there are any discrepancies prior to that vote being certified, there has to be an explanation. So if there were, you know, multiple canceled ballots, that would all be accounted for. And so that's why we went to the local election officials, the local jurisdictions, because they're the ones that are closest to this. They have to explain any any discrepancies. And so that is why we went to them. And that is how we were able to come up with these numbers in terms of potential voter fraud. And of course, you know, through the course of reporting, we determined and we saw numerous examples, for instance, in Georgia, of the 64 potential cases, 31 of them were identified as administrative errors or mistakes.
I want to key in on one story that got attention when it first came out in Nevada, a Las Vegas businessman named Donald Kirk Hartle claiming that to his late wife, someone had voted her name illegally. How did that story end up resolving?
Well, so yes, that that businessman from Las Vegas. So he had been one of those who initially raised the flag in concern in Nevada that double votes. He had reported that his wife, who had been dead, that a ballot had shown up in her name, and he raised concerns about that. After an investigation, that gentleman was charged with submitting a false ballot, and that case was resolved. His lawyer said that he had taken responsibility for his actions for submitting that ballot on behalf of his dead wife.
You talked to, or the AP talked to, former President Trump as part of this piece. How did he respond to your findings?
I did. I did speak with President Trump prior to publication. We wanted to have an opportunity to talk with him and to hear from him. And as I told you at the beginning of our conversation, I told him that we went looking for voter fraud, and this is what we found. And his response was to repeat a lot of the claims that have been made, the false claims regarding various instances across the country that he described as suspicious, but have been explained by election officials. And so, he told us that there would be a report that would be coming out, but he declined to tell us who was conducting this report. And he essentially said that, he thought we were being foolish by, publishing what he described as such a low number, because he believes still that voter fraud is and was much more widespread in the 2020 election.
Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Christina Cassidy, reporter for the AP's state government team, with us today to talk about their investigation into possible instances of voter fraud in battleground states during the 2020 election. They found fewer than 475 total cases of potential fraud across six states. President Biden won those six states by more than 310,000 votes collectively. Tomorrow on Central Time, tax season is on the way. The pandemic slowed things down for the IRS last year. What could things look like this time around? We'll get the latest tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at America's most broken law, speeding, and the reasons we do it, the cost of going too fast, and the efforts to get us to slow down. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at some of the challenges of teaching about racism and the civil rights movement in schools and colleges. First, when you're behind the wheel, would you admit to speeding sometimes in some places? If so, you're not alone. According to the auto insurance comparison site The Zebra, 9 in 10 drivers say they exceed the speed limit, even though 8 in 10 say it's dangerous, and about a third say it's always unacceptable. A 2016 AAA report showed that half of all drivers went 15 over the speed limit on the highway in the previous month. 45% said they went 10 over in residential areas. Officials say speeding is dangerous to everyone on the road. In fact, the National Highway Traffic Safety Association says in 2019, speeding killed more than 9,400 people in the U.S. That's about a quarter of all traffic deaths. Our next guest looked into Americans' addiction to speeding, including why we do it and efforts to slow us down, why he says the nation's most disobeyed law is, quote, dysfunctional from top to bottom. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you drive over the speed limit? If so, how fast do you go? Do you have a rule? 5 over or 10 over on the highway, say? Have you been pulled over and ticketed? Do you see a lot of unsafe, fast driving when you're out and driving? If you're a police officer, what do you see out on the roads? And are there changes you'd like to see to get us to slow down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate who focuses on cities, transportation, housing, and the environment. He's currently working on a book about parking. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
You describe speeding as a national health problem. Can you talk about why a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, I think you said so yourself in your introduction. Nearly 10,000 people die each year in collisions that involve speeding. There are thousands and thousands of more injuries that involve speeding. What's particularly perplexing about this is that even though cars are getting safer and safer for the people inside them, those numbers appear to be going up. In the first 6 months of 2021, traffic fatalities in the U.S. rose by about 18%, which is the largest increase since the U.S. DOT started counting. And that's double the rate of the previous year's surge, which happened in spite of the fact that everybody was staying home for 2 months of the year. So it's a deadly problem, and it's getting worse.
And people are paying a lot of attention to this. As you mentioned, with the pandemic, roads might have been emptier, but we were driving faster. I assume some data is still coming in, but what do we know about how the pandemic changed our driving speeds?
Yeah, so the pandemic shutdown lowered the total number of miles traveled in this country by 13%, which is not surprising when you think about the fact that many of us may not have gone to work or, you know, didn't go to social events. I mean, we're talking about March, April, May 2020. So the sort of when this was just a real public health emergency that was just beginning almost 2 years ago now. But in spite of vehicle miles traveled falling by 13%, the per mile death rate rose by 24%. That's the greatest increase in a century. And that's because everybody was going so fast on all these empty roads. But what's weird is that that didn't then revert back to the norm in 2021. On the contrary, as I just mentioned, in 2021, it looks like traffic fatalities rose again by 20%.
I want to split this up because highways and residential roads are kind of different stories in some ways. You mentioned how cars are safer for the people in them now. Let's get on those residential roads. Talk about the impact of speed on the people who aren't in the cars, the pedestrians, bicyclists.
Yeah, so that's huge. I mean, I think part of my thesis here is that, you know, we're making a mistake by treating speeding as one issue. Part of that is that there's a big difference between the risks that you create for the people around you when you go 5 miles over the speed limit on the interstate versus when you go 15 miles over the speed limit on a residential street. For pedestrians, whose death counts are also rising as part of that 10,000 deaths a year number, pedestrians' odds of being killed in a collision are about 10% when the driver is going 23 miles an hour, and they rise to 75% when the driver is going 50 miles an hour. So there's a really important zone there where we have cars and people existing in the same spaces where it's super important to get people to drive a little bit slower. And most people do, I think, drive at a safe speed through residential neighborhoods. But there are a few who don't, and they pose an outsized risk to those around them, not just people, but if you've ever seen an out-of-control car careen down a residential street, to structures as well.
Talking to Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate. He wrote a recent piece on Americans' love of speeding while driving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How big a problem do you think this is? What do you see from other people on the road? Do you drive over the speed limit often yourself? Do you want to see changes in enforcement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Henry, you point out there's a pretty common perception that when I drive fast, I'm doing it safely because I know what I'm doing. But those other idiots are driving fast. They're putting us all at risk. I don't know. What are we doing there?
Yeah, that's actually what drew me to this topic in the first place. I think there's lots of aspects of society where something is dangerous, but it's also fun and we like it. And so we permit it because that's, you know, society is a balancing act, right? Like, you know, fireworks or alcohol or something like that. Like these things obviously are not great for our health, but they're fun. And so we've decided they're going to be allowed. And what gets me about speeding is that simultaneously, everybody agrees that it's bad on a societal level and that other people shouldn't do it, but that when I do it, it's fine. And to me, it recalls a famous line of George Carlin's, who said, everyone going faster than you is a maniac, and everyone going slower than you is an idiot. And that seems to be the societal position on speeding.
Let's look at some solutions now. First of all, the drivers. Are there things we can do to educate ourselves on how to drive a safe? I guess we know driving slower is safer. How can we live that?
Yeah, there's a few things that I think we could do. I mean, a lot of the focus is on enforcement, right? It's like hire more state troopers, radar guns, speed cameras, all this stuff. And we can talk about that in a moment. But I think right off the bat, there's some fundamental changes we could make. I mean, the easiest one is to design roads to correspond to the speed that we want people to drive on them. I think often people feel that the road is telling them, suggesting a certain speed. And that's true. Engineers know when they design a road that there's a design speed at which it will feel safe. And if we want those roads, if we want people to drive slower on those roads, the best way to do it is to redesign them. And that's particularly true in the places where you have people turning in and out of driveways, you have kids crossing the street. Those are places where engineers really need to start redesigning roads with safety in mind, rather than just trying to get everyone, and when I say everyone, I mean drivers here, from point A to point B as fast as possible.
In my town and others around the state, I think sometimes there is that kind of redesign on the kind of streets you're talking about, but the only change is the number on the speed limit sign, 30 down to 25, 35 down to 30. I was on one such road today, and you know, maybe more enforcement, but no other physical changes to the road. Is that doomed to failure?
I think it is, yes. I think that that doesn't really work. We're all accustomed to not paying attention to the number posted on the speed limit sign, and for good reason. Nobody around us does. We know that the police don't really take this law at face value, which is to say they don't necessarily ticket you for going 1 or 2 miles an hour over. But yeah, I would argue that if we actually want people to slow down, and there's, we could redesign the streets, we can have a more rigorous program of driver education. I think it's kind of unusual that you learn to drive, you take an exam when you're 15 or 16 years old, and you're never tested again. It's a little surprising. And then the third thing, obviously, is we could put some sort of governor in the vehicles. And that could be for people who have a proven record of dangerous driving. Or the other thing, obviously, is that we're starting to see autonomous cars. And with those, it's not even a question of your personal liberty. It's do we want to have computer programs on the road that are going 20 miles over the speed limit? And that's a question I think we should probably address as a society before all those cars get put out there and you have computer programs that are directing them to go so far over the speed limit.
We're talking about Americans' apparent need for speed on the roads with Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate, who focuses on transportation and other issues. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you often see people driving too fast when you're driving on the highway, in your neighborhood maybe, or on downtown streets? What do you think we should do about it, if anything, if you are in law enforcement and have to pull people over? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, the idea of speed traffic cameras that will send you a ticket. 800-642-1234. What do you think of that? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about speeding on American roadways. Our guest wrote a piece about our apparent addiction to speeding on highways and residential roads. He notes that 1 in 4 deadly crashes in the U.S. involves at least one speeding driver. Henry Grabar is with us from Slate. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see too much speeding on the road? What would you do to fix it, to prevent it? What questions do you have about how we design our roads, how we enforce or sometimes don't enforce our laws? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Henry, before we go to our callers, I wanted to get into this automatic speeding camera ticket idea. Big in Europe, not so hot yet in the United States.
No, people hate them. And this is a point on which I think that having written this big article about speeding, I think my take has diverged from that of most people. I think the greater infringement on our liberties is probably having an armed police officer pull you over at 90 miles an hour and search your vehicle, as opposed to a camera sending you a ticket in the mail. I appear to be in the minority in holding that view, but the argument in favor of it is that if we're trying to actually clamp, like if we're trying to crack down on dangerous speeding, which I think we can all agree is a minority of drivers on the road, you know them when you see them, they're weaving in out of lanes, going 25 over the limit. Our current system of, you know, having a policeman here and there with a radar gun is just not that good for catching those people. And the argument for cameras is that if you install them in places where you have, say, pedestrians, cyclists, parents with strollers, you know, vulnerable people, you create a much more effective system of enforcement. And once the system of enforcement is more effective, you can say lower the fines, right? Because you're catching more people. You can adjust the way the cameras work so you don't, you know, get everybody going over the speed limit, but maybe only get people going 15 or 20 above. And then finally, you get a pretty good data set of who the dangerous drivers are, which we definitely do not get when we rely on speeding tickets, because, as you know, you can speed for years and years without getting a speeding ticket. It's not a particularly, it's not a data set that tells us a lot about who the dangerous drivers are.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Evan is with us in Ashland. Evan, hi.
Hey, I think, at least in where I live, part of the issue with speeding is just, it's kind of an issue with road design. There's a, I want to say Highway 2 runs into town. It's a two lanes each way, four lane highway. And going in through Ashland, it's still four lanes, two lanes each way. But the speed limit just it gets cut from 55.
We lost Evan there, but 55, I'm guessing down to something like 25 going through downtown Ashland. How big a problem is this, Henry, that kind of design? We have this. This is common in Wisconsin. You are 55 until the road takes you through town.
Yeah, I think that is not an effective method of getting people to slow down. I myself have gotten a ticket in one such situation in upstate New York. And the truth is, as a driver, you just, at a certain point, you just don't read those signs. The real thing that you're taking your cues from is the way the road is designed. And there's lots of really easy things we can do to signal to drivers that they are entering a densely populated area where they need to slow down. And the fact that we just rely on a sign on the side of the road, I think, is a sign maybe of a sort of lazy approach to design, but also potentially reminds us that the way speeding works is it's a system for raising revenue in a lot of places. And so, you know, in some places you do wonder, do authority figures actually want people to slow down, or do they want to issue speeding tickets?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Bill now in the Northwoods. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. I wanted to wish everybody a happy COVID-free New Year. And I really enjoy your topic. And one thing I've been kind of scrolling through the internet, thank God for that, that a lot of these police officers, and they're finding out with traffic stops and expired plates and speeding, that they're better off to just photograph them and send pictures or the tickets in the mail, because traffic stops can escalate to, you know, a dangerous situation for the officer.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Henry, you were starting to touch on that, and that's something you do focus on in your piece. Fewer interactions between a traffic enforcement officer and drivers might make people safer in other ways.
Yeah, I that is such an important part of this, Bill. Thank you for bringing it up. I mean, where to begin? We know, I think, fewer interactions with police would be a good thing from a civil liberties perspective. It would be good for police because it would free up their time to do more important work, solving crimes and stopping crimes. The other thing is, Bill hinted at this, but there are statistics. Getting pulled over on the highway is the number one way that Americans interact with police. It serves as the start of one in three police shootings. So this is not like a niche little thing, right? This is basically the foundation of Americans' experience with the police. And speed cameras, whatever your problems may be with them, offer great promise in sort of getting rid of the traffic stop as a concept.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Henry Grabar from Slate, looking at speeding in America, its risks, how to deal with it. Back to your calls now. Kristen is with us in Eau Claire. Kristen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I thought that the cameras would be a more equitable solution because in general, there's a perception that maybe racial and gender bias causes more men and people of color to be pulled over than Caucasian people, and that the use of cameras would eliminate that bias.
Kristen, thanks for the call. Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, there's more than a suggestion. Black drivers are 20% more likely to be stopped, according to a study from last year, or rather that would be 2020. And this is because part of the dysfunctional nature of the speed limit is that it makes criminals of us all, because it is a law that we all disobey, that we know is sort of meant to be disobeyed, that engineers know we're going to disobey, police know we're going to disobey. And yes, it gives the police the right to ostensibly pull anyone over at all. And so I don't think that the system we have is good at all. And I agree, cameras can be theoretically, at least, a race-neutral method of enforcing the law, in addition to avoiding the sometimes tragic consequences of highway stops. Of course, the program to install the cameras has to be well-designed and not designed with the aim of raising revenue, but rather with the aim of ensuring public safety on the road. I think that's important.
Kristen, thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Cyril in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to mention that speed not only is an unsafe habit for drivers, but just generally bad driving habits in particular, such as coming to an intersection and you're going to make a turn and you decide to cut the corner so that you don't have to turn the steering wheel as far, and having a vehicle coming on the opposite lane coming towards you as you're cutting the corner. I live within distance of a major intersection where it's only a two-way stop, and every year since we've moved here, and I've lived here 30 years, there's been at least one or two crash and boom
wow.
accidents.
Well, Cyril, stay safe there. Henry, I wonder how much of a problem like that and like speeding is we need to be better drivers versus we need to design our roads better.
I think the two go together. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, Cyril, but like when it snows, and the snow has first fallen and there's this thick layer of snow on the road, if you look at the road from above, you start to see the paths that drivers take, and you start to realize how much of the space of the road is actually not being used by drivers. And I love to look at that in, say, a little, you know, downtown of a small town. And if you look at that from above, you get a sense of, does all this space really need to be roadway space? And I think that drivers respond to all that space being asphalt by doing things like cutting corners. But when it snows, you sort of get a sense of really, we could begin to build out, say, a sidewalk here, build out a planter full of trees there, and reduce the amount of space that drivers have. And that's one way that design cues get people to slow down and drive more safely, irrespective of even if we're making them, you know, take a class or something like that.
Cyril, thanks for that call. In just our last half a minute, Henry, do you see at the federal, state, or local levels people saying, hey, yeah, the speeding's a problem, we got to try something different?
You know who did say something about this was the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, who was talking about the rise in fatalities since the pandemic started. And he said, we cannot and should not accept these fatalities. Unfortunately, when it comes to redesigning the roads, we have not seen, I would say, a ton of movement. And the other thing is that speed cameras remain incredibly unpopular, notwithstanding the opinions of WPR callers.
Henry, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate who focuses on cities and transportation. We talked to him about what he calls our addiction to speeding. Coming up after the news, a historian and teaching educator joins us to look at bills in the Wisconsin legislature that would limit or prohibit teaching about systemic racism in the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.